because the people of Israel must never again face the horror that a terrorist organization called Hamas caused on October 7.
Oh, Kamala last night at the Democratic National Convention accepting the party's nomination and speaking for about 36 minutes. She spoke for almost 12 minutes less than Joe Biden, who, by the way.
Well, don't you always kind of say a great speech?
Yes.
You know, how's your line go, basically?
If you
people remember a great short speech more than a great long speech, essentially.
If you give a good short speech, people remember you gave a good speech. If you give a good long speech, people remember you gave a long speech.
Boom, yeah.
Kamala Harris.
She held to the Carlson corollary there.
Well, in one way, in terms of length.
Sure.
In terms of substance,
well, okay.
You know, where's the substance inside all this cotton candy?
Well, I thought remarkable was she comes off like a moderate, and this is completely opposite of what we've seen and heard from her and what she's said and what she's done as a candidate in 2020 and a senator before that.
This is the first time in my adult life, I have ever heard a partisan Democrat or liberal crowd at any rally chant USA, USA. It's never happened before. And, of course, they were passing out American flags for people to wave. Clearly, this is all choreography. This is, hey, we're the ones who are pro-America. We're the ones who believe in freedom. We're the ones who are moderate. None of it's really true. Okay.
Window dressing, right?
But again, the Democrats put on a really good show. The question is, will they get away with something like this? That's up to the Republicans, because the media are not going to help them. We'll get into that. Another media attempt to uncork a huge, massive scandal on Donald Trump completely backfires on PBS. We'll be getting into that as well. But first, let's get into the convention speech, which I watched and wrote notes throughout so that you wouldn't have to, so I could tell you what was important. Here is my take on Kamala Harris's convention speech last night. The best speech given this week in Chicago at the Democratic National Convention by a black woman was Michelle Obama. She gave the most powerful, forceful speech. The second best speech given by an African-American woman at the Democratic National Convention this week was Oprah Winfrey. Kamala Harris's speech comes in third. Here's one way of spinning it. She delivered her speech much better than Joe Biden has delivered a speech in a couple of years. It was very heavy at the beginning on biography, on her life. She left out the fact that she spent much of her childhood and teen years in Canada. That entire part was left out. The attacks on Trump began about 14, 15 minutes into the 36-minute address. And after attacking Trump, she waited very tentatively, maybe dipped a big toe into policy when she said that she will provide a middle class tax cut. It was completely unclear what that tax cut would be and exactly how she defines middle class. She said that she would sign the compromise immigration reform bill that Donald Trump, to his vast credit, helped defeat. It was a terrible bill. It would have basically, and why some Washington, D.C. Republicans got behind this, I do not know. This is why you must be perpetually skeptical of Republicans in the nation's capital. They do really dumb stuff. The Republicans came this close. My fingers are an inch and a half apart. They came this close to agreeing to a bill, voting for a bill that would have established a tolerance policy on illegal immigration, that the Democrats would start to enforce border security when more than 2,000 illegals a day were streaming into the country, breaching the border. And the argument they used is, well, you've been critical, you Republicans, that 8 to 10,000 a day are getting through. How about we lower it to 1,500, 2,000, maybe 2,500? And Republican senators who were negotiating that bill went, okay, yeah, that's a big reduction. Idiots. The correct number is not 2,500 or 2,000 or 1,500 or 10,000 a day. The correct number is zero. You enforce the law. You don't start to enforce a law when the breach gets too noticeable. And that's what that bill was, that Donald Trump did not kill that bill to help his campaign. He killed that bill to stop terrible policy that, by the way, would have been politically catastrophic for the Republicans, because then the Republicans are the party of open borders, just a little less open than the Democrats. So she said she'd sign that bill. And a lot of people didn't notice this. She promised a earned pathway to citizenship. She said 21 minutes in that Donald Trump doesn't care about the middle class. And yet the frustration for the Democrats is that they're having trouble breaking through to the middle class because they feel more comfortable with the results of Donald Trump's policies, 1.5% inflation, energy independence, much lower prices, than they are with the Democrats' policies. The best critique of her speech that I heard actually came from Donald Trump right after her speech wrapped up. They got him on the phone on Fox News, Brett Baer and Shannon Bream, and Trump's reaction was spot on correct. Have a listen.
What is your first reaction to it real time tonight?
Well, the biggest reaction is, why didn't she do the things that she's complaining about? All of these things that she talked about, we're going to do this, we're going to do that, we're going to do everything, but she didn't do any of it. She could have done it 3.5 years ago. She could do it tonight by leaving the auditorium and going to Washington, D.C. and closing the border. She doesn't need a bill. I didn't have a bill. I closed the border and created the safest border we've ever had in the history of our country. She could.
Boom. Point, set, and match on that one to Donald Trump. That's what he should say when they eventually have their debate. Let's have it sooner rather than later. The Democrats might be trying to pull a Fetterman here. Do you remember? You know what I mean, Philip J. Vandenberg III, when I say they're trying to pull a Fetterman?
How he is kind of reversed some of his...
No. And we're happy to see that he's reversing the effects of his stroke. But when he was still debilitated from his stroke, he agreed to debate his opponent, Mehmet Oz.
Right. Just a re-election
terrible
thing.
Terrible candidate. Anyway, he agreed to debate Dr. Oz in mid-October, or was it late October?
Okay, close to the election.
Yeah, we can't fit it on the schedule. He's going to be, up in, he's going to be Pittsburgh, and then he just isn't available. Maybe we could do it sometime in the third week of October or so. Well, early voting had started.
Yeah, I was going to say, a lot of votes are already cast.
So there's some concern that since some polling places, early voting begins at the end of September for some states, that they may be trying to wait. But that what Trump said is exactly right. Said everything you talked about in your convention speech, you're the incumbents. You're acting like you're the challenger. You're not. You're the incumbent. Why haven't you and Joe, why hasn't the Biden-Harris administration done these things? Why haven't you produced these results? You say you're going to do this stuff on day one. You could do it right now. You're on day 1201. So I think that Trump's got it a really good take on this. And then he goes on we may have to start the very beginning again here.
What is your first reaction to it, real time, tonight?
Well, the biggest reaction, leaving the auditorium and going to Washington, D.C., and closing the border. She doesn't need a bill. I didn't have a bill. I closed the border and created the safest border we've ever had in the history of our country. She could have done all of these things, and she could still do them. She's got 4.5-5 months left. She can go there right now. She can do all of the things, many of the things that she's talking about and complaining about. It was a lot of complaining. She didn't talk about China.
Again, what Trump is saying is demonstrably, factually true. It's a very reasonable response. If you want to do all this, you're part of the Biden-Harris administration. Why isn't it happening? Why haven't these things happened? Where are those results? Again, you guys are the incumbents. Quit trying to act like you're the challengers and I'm the incumbent. Donald Trump's not responsible for these policies. He's not responsible for the miserable results of these policies. You are. So why haven't you fixed these things? Why aren't you fixing them right now? Fair point. Then he goes on to talk about what she didn't talk about. She didn't talk about China, for instance.
She didn't talk about fracking. She didn't talk about crime. She didn't talk about 70% of our people are living in poverty. She didn't talk about housing, really. The trade deficit she didn't talk about. Child trafficking that she's allowed to happen because she was the border czar and she presided over the weakest border in the history of our country. It's an invasion. I was there today, as you know, Brett. It's an invasion of our country taking place at our border, our southern border.
By the way, Trump actually had to halt an interview, mid-interview with News Nation, because where he was no longer deemed to be safe to continue the interview by Border Patrol officials. So they literally had to move in the middle of an interview. That's how close he was to, quote, the action.
It's a total invasion, and now it's starting at our northern border also, through Canada. And she didn't talk about any of that, because she talks, but she doesn't do. It's no action. But, look, other than that, it was a nice-looking room.
A nice-looking room. And it was, by the way. It kind of looked, if you had the sound off, it looked like a Republican convention. So
you talked about the American flags and some of the red, white, and blue stuff and the USA chant
the
that had
red, white, and blue
occurred
bunting?
At least at one point.
Absolutely. If you turned the sound down and just looked at the convention, looked at the room, the auditorium, looked at the people waving the flags, it looked like a Republican convention. The Democrats are trying to ape, to echo, to imitate the Republicans' look in order for them to break through with a lot of middle America. They understood, give them credit, they understood that the way the room looked and what they said, which is why so much of what Kamala Harris said was free of substance, was a free ad to the country at large. You're not just, yes, it's a Democratic convention. You're not talking just to Democrats. You are talking to America, all America. And she was very shrewd to point that out in and acknowledge it in her speech. We got a lot more on the Democrats' last night in Chicago and her speech. If you have your own reactions to the convention generally and Kamala Harris's acceptance speech, we want to hear from you. Text us your comments at 206-421-5757. That's 206-421-5757. Outside, it's very dark. You know, I saw what appeared to be, I was coming over the bridge, and it was early. It was like 4 o'clock in the morning, and or about 4:30 in the morning, and it looked like there was some sort of blazing fire over in South Seattle. But again, couldn't place it because it was much closer to I-90 and I was driving 520. Anyway, it is 20 minutes after 6. Philip J. Vandervoort III's got your first social media moment of the morning right when we come back. And speaking of that, it's 6:20. Good morning. 23 minutes after 6 o'clock in the morning on the John Carlson Show. Philip J. Vandervoort III, is it a busy social media morning?
Oh, yeah. I can always find stuff on social media. That is no trick. And I've got one I want to start off with that kind of goes to all these things that have repeatedly come up in the last week, starting last Friday with Kamala Harris's big speech on her economic agenda or her economic plan, economic policy plan. And then things at the convention this week, the social media sweep sponsored by Muckleshoot Casino Resort. And this one comes by way of an essay from Reason.com and the old Reason magazine, libertarian kind of publication.
Very good.
And they posted on their social media handle, Democrats, Kamala Harris, are asking voters to accept some head-spinning logic. A, the American economy is stronger than ever, but it also needs radical government action and intervention. And this kind of goes to some of the Kamala Harris comments last week unveiling her economic policy plan or economic policy agenda, and including things that you've talked about dating back to last Friday, price controls. The essay is by a guy named Eric Boehm, B-O-E-H-M.
Okay.
And it's, the headline says, if Joe Biden saved the economy, why do we need Kamala Harris's price controls? And in the essay, it says, the actual economic signals are mixed bag right now. Unemployment has ticked up, raising fears of a possible recession on the horizon. High interest rates have replaced high inflation, which means many Americans are still feeling a squeeze on personal finances. If you're carrying any credit card debt, stuff like that, Biden doesn't deserve the applause he's getting. But there's also not a crisis that would demand the sort of radical actions Kamala Harris is proposing, even if the actions that she is proposing actually worked. Parenthetically, they don't. And then there's this line. And of course, those high prices are largely the fault of government overspending backed by heavy borrowing during and after the pandemic. So that's the summation from the Reason.com piece. And then pointing out what you mentioned in the last segment about some of the speeches this week in Chicago. Remember, it was Michelle Obama who says in the speech, something wonderfully magical is in the air, isn't it? It's the contagious power of hope. And the Democrats trying to hang their hat on this intangible rather than anything substantive. All right, let's – I got to add one more about the social media post about the convention this week. And this one responds to Democrats going after J.D. Vance for growing up in Ohio, poor, impoverished circumstances, and then managing to get into an Ivy League school, and then apparently the criticism that he has ditched Ohio after graduating from an Ivy League school.
Can you believe that criticism?
Yeah. So,
how dare you go to Yale after you went to Ohio State?
So
that's like criticizing him for ditching Ohio to join the Marines.
Yeah, yeah. That's been one of the other responses from some of these Democrats that are going after J.D. Vance. So this comes from White House reporter Real Clear Politics. And this guy's name is Philip Wegman, and he posted, introducing himself to the Democratic National Committee convention 20 years ago, a little-known Harvard law grad named Barack Obama said his parents, quote, imagined me going to the best schools in the land, end quote, because they realized, quote, in a generous America, you don't have to be rich to achieve your potential, end quote. 20 years later, after Obama introduced himself by saying an Ivy League school was part of his American dream, what did Tim Walz do? Tim Walz told Democratic convention goers and delegates in Chicago that none of his classmates went to Yale. So weird flex, as the kids like to say. Weird flex. But, you know, there's Tim Walz trying to be Tim Walz. Now, I know that you're going to get into this a little bit later in the show. The Seattle Mariners ditched their manager yesterday, and that's Scott Servais. He's been with the Mariners for 9.5 years.
How about that?
I remarked to my—
didn't even wait till the end of the season.
My group of high school buddies and I who grew up Mariner fans, and mostly Alvin Davis, Harold Reynolds, Mark Langston, some of those years before we got to really appreciate things with Ken Griffey Jr., Jay Buhner, and all that good stuff. And I remarked to some of my buddies, Scott Servais was a career 245 hitter in his major league playing days, and that's about the equivalent that he is as a manager. But somebody on social media posted Jerry DePoto, a former Major League Baseball player who's currently the Mariners president, GM, kind of makes all the roster moves and the player decisions. And the video clip is probably from around 1997, 98, 99, somewhere in there. And it's Jerry DePoto with the Colorado Rockies pitching to Scott Servais with the San Francisco Giants. And Jerry DePoto comes in from the bullpen and strikes out Scott Servais getting out of a jam. So somebody has kind of posted
Jerry DePoto strikes
as the pitcher,
out Scott Servais.
Yes, going head-to-head in a game back in the late 90s when both were active players in the major leagues. And it just adds insult to injury when somebody wants to post that video.
Well, now DePoto got back at him.
After DePoto, fire Scott Servais.
DePoto gets the last word on that one, doesn't he?
All righty. Good luck to Scott Servais and the unemployment line.
And, you know, it's a shame.
It happens. It's tough business.
You
but
know,
Scott Servais has had opportunity after opportunity. The players have had opportunity after opportunity. And they keep squandering these opportunities. So what are you going to do?
It just seems, Phil, whenever the Mariners have a great pitching staff, the bats go cold.
Yeah.
Whenever we've got a great batting lineup, our pitching is terrible.
And they bring these batters that have a great prior track record to Seattle, and all of a sudden they go into the Bermuda Triangle and they can't hit at Climate Pledge, Safeco, T-Mobile Arena.
It's T-Mobile this year.
Right? So what is it that these Mariner ball players can't seem to hit at their home stadium?
It's 6:30, The Commute with Carlson, Talk Radio 570. A lot more national and local news on the radio program of record straight ahead. Back we are on the John Carlson Show, 26 minutes to 7 o'clock in the morning. I've got to play this clip. This was so much fun. Do you know Steve Cortez? Philip J.
I had not before you pointed all this out to me this morning.
So
yeah, no, Steve.
He must have a healthy sense of humor.
Well, yes, and he is a conservative commentator, and he does a radio show, and he does some makes appearances on national media outlets. Currently, he's with the Trump campaign, and he decided to have a little bit of fun. So he finds an illegal immigrant from Venezuela. That was not the hard part. Okay. And who looks to be, you know, a good-natured, skinny young guy. I'm thinking early 20s.
If he's early 20s, he's a very young-looking early 20s.
Yeah.
So
early 20s or so, wearing a baseball cap and a jacket. And he decides, since he's entered the country illegally, then certainly it should be no problem for him to enter the Democratic National Convention. So he took the young man, Edwin, who has no ID, no credentials, to the security checkpoint. Now, this is not the actual building where the convention's held. There is a perimeter, a fenced perimeter around the convention center area in Chicago, as there was in Milwaukee when we were there for the Republican National Convention. So he's taking him to the outside perimeter, trying to get into the interior of the perimeter and then walk a couple of blocks to the convention center. Here's what happened.
Hey, Steve Cortez here on the west side of Chicago, Democratic National Convention at United Center. The Democrats, of course, want open borders and want an endless stream of illegal migrants pouring into the United States. This is my new acquaintance, Edwin. Say hello.
My name is Edwin. Nice to meet you.
Right, Edwin is from Venezuela. And we're going to take Edwin into the DNC so that he can meet the Democrats who want open borders. He should meet his new friends, hear the speakers, and learn about the Democratic Party. So, Edwin, let's head in, shall we?
So they go to the checkpoint. Here they are at the checkpoint.
This is Edwin from Venezuela, migrant, invited in by the Democrat Party. He'd like to come into the Democratic Convention.
Now, there's about eight uniformed security and police officers manning the security checkpoint. Again, you've got black screen fencing all around this area.
You have to get your credentials. Yep, you have to go to Jackson.
Yep. Wait, you mean he needs credentials and permission to come in
yes.
to get past the wall?
Yeah.
It's like a border wall in a way, huh?
Yeah. You have to have ID.
To come to the United States?
No.
Not to come to the United States. Okay, but to come to the Democratic Convention.
Here,
okay. You believe in security. You believe in securing a boundary. Edwin can't come in.
That's all I know.
I commend you on guarding this border.
Okay. Did you hear the part where he says to the lady, he needs credentials? That's right. To come into the country? No. Oh, to come into the convention. Listen.
Migrant, invited in by the Democrat Party. He'd like to come into the Democrat Convention.
You have to get your credentials. Yep, you have to go to Jackson.
Yep.
Wait, you mean he needs credentials and permission to come in?
Yes.
To get past the wall?
Yeah.
It's like a border wall in a way, huh?
Yeah. You have to have ID. Credentials.
Okay. To come to the United States?
No.
Not to come to the United States. Okay, but to come to the Democratic Convention. Okay.
You need credentials. To get into the country? No. To get into the convention. All right. Oh, that's kind of cute. Making a point. All right. I already told you, I thought the best speeches, if I was to rate the speeches, Barack Obama and Michelle Obama, you know, give them their due. They are great speakers. Barack Obama in particular is a superb orator. Again, you might not agree with a word that comes out of his mouth, but it comes out very smooth, very articulate, eloquent.
Just powerful.
Inspiring, right? And powerful. Michelle Obama, very forceful. She would be a much tougher opponent, in my opinion, than Kamala Harris.
And I thought about that with Oprah Winfrey's speech. Oprah Winfrey would clobber.
Oprah too.
Yeah, Donald Trump candidacy, Kamala Harris candidacy, probably 3-1, maybe 4-1.
Well, I don't know if she. I don't know if she would beat Trump, but she would be more formidable than Kamala Harris, and Michelle Obama would have been a very tough opponent. Again, those were the two best speakers. I think are the best three speakers. And then at the top of the second tier, I would say that Kamala Harris gave a good, vacuous, but she delivered her speech very well. Now, who was the worst speaker at the convention? I am going to nominate the Lieutenant Governor of California, Eleni Kunalakis is the Lieutenant Governor of California. I say this because when you hear this short clip, you might not believe that's the person who's a heartbeat away from running the state of California. As Philip Jay points out, the fifth leading economy in the world? Yes. Here is part of her convention speech earlier this week.
She cares. She cares so much that if you're lucky enough to be her friend, she calls you on her birthday and sometimes she sings to you. She called me on mine right when I had decided to run for lieutenant governor. She asked tough questions. I promised I'd follow her lead and invest in the future. Together, we shattered that glass ceiling, California, and got to work.
Okay, that's all I can take. But, we shattered that glass ceiling. What glass ceiling? California has had female U.S. senators since the 90s. Barbara Boxer, Dianne Feinstein, who passed away last year at the age of 174. So what glass ceiling are you talking about? Lieutenant Governor? You shattered a glass ceiling to cut ribbons? I mean, but no, that is the worst speech that I'm aware of from the Democratic National Convention. Eleni Kunalakis, the lieutenant governor, and you could just see Kamala saying, please tell me this speech is happening so early in the program. Nobody is watching. Not a lot of people were watching. We were. We caught it. You are listening to The John Carlson Show, Talk Radio 570 KVI. By the way, have you noticed that, you know, this is August, which is usually very warm and very sunny, and it seems to have really kind of cooled off.
Yeah, I'm sure that's happened at some point in my lifetime, 55 years old now, but I don't remember it being quite like this cool for this long with this much rain. I mean, I woke up last night to rain pouring on my roof. That's a rarity. I mean, getting this much rain in August is a rarity here.
So we won't know for another week or so. We still have another week of August, but this might go down as one of our coldest Augusts on record.
I mean, it's tough to imagine one that would have been cooler than what we've experienced so far. 23 days now into August?
Yes. The theme of this convention was freedom. What the Democrats are trying to do here is recast the election from how are we doing, which when you're the incumbent party and you're running, whether it's Joe Biden for a second term or my vice president running for a second term or for what would be my second term. And they are trying, instead of running on their record, to keep it vague, keep it general, and then just hate on Donald Trump. Just attack Donald Trump. Try and demonize him personally, because you can't, what are you going to demonize his record on the border? You're going to demonize his performance on inflation? Prices have gone up twice as high in the last 3.5 years as they did during the Trump presidency. So, you know, you've kept the world a safer place? Really? Doesn't look like it. Doesn't seem like it. So they can't run against Trump's record, so they're just going to try and demonize him. And by the way, did you notice, because I wrote it down when I was watching the speech last night, early on, about a minute or so into her acceptance speech, she says some wonderful moving, affectionate words about Joe Biden and what he has meant to her in her life and what he has meant to the country and how heroic he is and how we will never forget him. And then at about the 2-minute mark, never mentioned him again. No one's pointing this out.
Good catch.
Joe Biden, who, you know, thank you, Joe. Thank you, Joe. You know, this huge pageantry built around Joe Biden on the first night, okay, when he was there, has all but evaporated. Kamala Harris says some nice things about him in the first couple of minutes of her speech, and then leaves him completely behind, completely in the dust. Wonder why the mainstream media kind of leaving that part out. But again, you don't think this guy was pushed off stage? It is 6:48, 12 minutes to 7 o'clock. Our good buddy Lars Larson, noon to 3 host, checking in. Un momento on the commute with Carlson. Okay, this is a Northwest band, but Philip J. won't tell me what it is.
I just stumbled on this one myself, and I thought, 1965, it's a song from the 60s in the 6 o'clock hour. Let's spin it and see where it goes. This is the Kingsmen.
Oh, okay.
This song is called The Jolly Green Giant, and I was today years old when I first heard the song Jolly Green Giant by the Kingsmen.
Oh, yeah. I still remember the ad. You know, in the Valley of the Jolly.
All of us remember that TV
Green
campaign,
Giant.
Right? Yep. Yeah.
All right. Back to 2024. Back to the 21st century.
As long as we're bragging on things, I know a member of the Kingsmen.
Oh, no kidding. How'd you get to?
Yeah, he works at a cigar store that I go to, and he still lives in the Portland metro area. Because as you remember, Louie was famously recorded at a tiny little recording studio in Portland way back when. That song's been covered, I think it's more than 500 times by 500 different artists.
Wow. Wow. Yeah. Who wrote it? Who gets the royalties?
I honestly don't remember who wrote it.
All right. Our good friend Lars Larson, who just loved Kamala Harris's speech last night, ladies and gentlemen.
Oh, you know, I think she forgot her I love fracking button back in her hotel room, didn't wear that. But you can tell she's for fracking. She's for hiring the cops. She's for law and order. She supports Israel. Apparently, not like Joe Biden, who was supporting the protesters out in the streets.
They got a point. They got a point out there.
That moral equivalence crap from Joe, too many innocents have died on both sides. Well, guess what? The innocents died in Israel because of Hamas, and any innocents who die in Gaza die because of Hamas.
Yes.
You know, and you say, if somebody surrounds himself or themselves with hostages and their own people and says, you can't shoot me unless you want to shoot these innocent people. I hate to say it, but in every single conflict, I think, in the world, there have been innocent people who have died. You know, ask, if you don't believe me, conjure up the ghosts of Dresden and ask them whether there are any children or old people who died when Dresden was bombed.
Well, we don't even need to go back that far. Let's stick with 2024. Did you hear Kamala Harris talk about the terrible toil that the war has taken on civilians in Ukraine?
Yep. Yep.
I didn't. I didn't hear her talk about civilian death.
No, the point is, they don't, and I don't know if she knows where she should stand on a whole bunch of these things, because I think Ukraine was wrong to begin with, and Putin was wrong to invade. Joe was wrong to invite him to invade, and we were wrong to back it, because all we've done is prolong it. And the fact is, every time there were peace deals in the works before the Russians entered Ukraine, and the West waved them off because I think Joe wanted a conflict with Russia, okay. And that's evidenced by his statements in the last 2 years saying we're not going to stop till Russia is defeated. What does that mean?
We are going to, yes, that's a very good point. What does that actually mean, Russia is defeated? That they stop fighting? That they withdraw?
Or that we disarm one of the nuclear superpowers on the planet. Good luck with that.
I want to ask, because we're going to be talking about that, her foreign policy remarks in the second hour of the show. Did you catch the attempt by PBS? They thought they had a sensational scoop that Donald Trump was caught red-handed trying to get Benjamin Netanyahu.
Oh, yeah, this.
Yes.
Yeah.
To not have a ceasefire until after the election, because if there was peace in Gaza, it would hurt his campaign and it would help Kamala Harris.
They lied.
They went public with this. And you're absolutely correct. It was completely made up. Not only was the so-called phone call between Donald Trump and Benjamin Netanyahu mischaracterized, the phone call never happened. There was no phone call.
Yep.
And yet it
made. By the way, I think Trump's well aware of the Logan Act, and he knows that if the current regime gets an excuse to charge him with the Logan Act, even though nobody's ever been charged with it over all these hundreds of years, they would do it. They'd do it in a heartbeat. They'd do it at the last minute.
So here's PBS not exaggerating, not engaging in hyperbole, but actually repeating out loud on their airwaves, Judy Woodruff, a lie, a completely made up story. She had to apologize for it, and said, you know, we just got this wrong. So it was good that she apologized, but again, here we go again. They want it to be true, so they report things without checking. And back we are, The Commute with Carlson, Talk Radio 570 KVI. Man, it is Friday. Doesn't that feel good? Doesn't Friday feel good? Oh, great weekend ahead, and we'll get back to our coverage of the Democratic National Convention. Democrats leaving town after Kamala Harris's speech last night, which I thought was very well delivered, but kind of vacuous, didn't have the force, the oomph, the punch of Barack Obama or Michelle Obama or Oprah Winfrey, but, well, it was better than Joe Biden would have done. Anyway, We'll be getting into that more at the bottom of the hour with frequent Fox News guest and our chief economist, Steve Moore, joining us at 7:35. Right now, I want to begin what's going to be a series of profiles of important races here in Washington State between now and the November election. There's a certain number of offices, most of them statewide, but some legislative races as well, that are particularly important, either because of the office itself or because of the candidates running. Some of those candidates are really bad and need to be defeated. Some of those candidates are really good, rising stars, and need to be supported. And in the case of the Washington State Senate, the 28th District in Pierce County, both the incumbent senator from the Lakewood area, Tonia Nobles, is one of the more radical members of the Senate. She's being challenged by Maya Espinoza, who I know well, who is a rising star in politics. I love how she describes herself, a mom-trepreneur. She's been very active in the community and in politics for a long time. Executive director and the founder, in fact, of the Center for Latino Leadership. She's the Republican challenger in that race, and she has taken a high profile after that Seattle Times page one story about the stunning amount of reoffending going on committed by sexually violent convicted criminals who have been released by the Inslee administration when they didn't have to. Maya Espinoza, welcome to the John Carlson Show. How are you this morning?
Good morning, John. Glad to be with you. Thanks so much for having me on.
All right. This issue is an outrage statewide, but most particularly where you live.
Yeah, well, as many may know, Lakewood is home to Western State Hospital, and the 28th District is also home to McNeil Island, this detention center, which houses the most violent, dangerous offenders, literally on an island, isolated away from people. And, you know, what we're talking about this morning, John, is this outrageous finding by the Seattle Times, surprisingly, actually, that violent criminals are being released into our neighborhoods slowly, quietly, without notice, and they are going on to recommit these violent crimes. This is an outrage. DSHS doesn't track this information. The state has no oversight on purpose. And so I am calling, I'm calling on Senator Nobles to join with me to ask the secretary, the head of DSHS, to step down and resign immediately.
I want to reiterate something important for our listeners. These are sex offenders who have been deemed most likely to reoffend, so likely to reoffend, and driven by mental illness that after their sentences have been served, they are still deemed so dangerous that they have been sent to McNeil Island to an entity of the Washington Corrections Department called the Special Commitment Center. Used to be out at Monroe. They moved it to McNeil Island. And they are supposed to receive mental health treatment and ongoing monitoring and not released until everyone is secure that it's a safe bet. It's safe to let them out. And under the Inslee administration, Maya, the number of these sexual psychopaths has exponentially increase being released.
Yep.
Why is that happening?
Well, so this time it's about money. And we know it's an excuse because we have such a budget surplus. There's always plenty of things to spend and save money on. But in this case, they said it would be more cost effective if we allowed if we made it easier to release these people into our communities. And this, again, was done quietly, that there are very simple things that can be done to notify the public. And frankly, we ought to be doing some oversight. But the reason that they don't want to do the oversight is they know they will become liable for what does happen when they get released, which is reoffend, hurt, and kill people. This has happened.
Yes.
And it's just absolutely outrageous that we shirk our responsibilities this way. But frankly, as you know, John, this is what happens when you have an unchecked majority for a number of years that feel like they can go completely unchallenged. There will be no challenge.
Yeah. No, that is the problem, is that it's not that the Democrats have a one-party majority in both houses, is that their numbers are so strong. They outnumber the Republicans by so much that the most radical members are having the most influence in both the House and the Senate.
Right.
And your opponent's one of them.
She is. She's very much an outlier in what is very largely considered a purple district. We encompass Joint Base Lewis-McChord, Steilacoom, DuPont, University Place, and parts of Spanaway. So as a, you know, far less left extremist, this vote that she took to make it easier for these predators to come off of the island and live and be planted in our communities is not out of character for her. She's very much the defund the police type. She voted twice for that police pursuit ban. I mean, it's very consistent with this type of character. But when you have a Democratic supermajority, which is what they're hoping for this year, they do think they can get away with it. But as you mentioned in your intro, John, this is one of those races that we could actually flip.
Yeah.
It's a purple district. She's an outlier and extremist. And I'm calling on her to prove to us she's not.
Yes. Well, I think we've got all the evidence we need to show where her true colors really are politically. And I think you fit that district much better. And I think that you would be a huge improvement. Again, you've got a Seattle-style radical representing, for crying out loud, Fort Lewis and DuPont, the area around there, which is heavy military. Why isn't that a Republican district, Maya?
You know, it used to be, and a Republican held the Senate seat at least for the last 50 years. But prior to that, it's always been, you know, two seats Republican, one seat blue. It's the national trend that has, you know, changed things. And frankly, it's Republican apathy. It's not the first time, I'm sure you've heard, that Republicans aren't turning out. We've lost faith. People need to know in this district and in this part of the state, and as you know, statewide, we do have a chance, but we do have to believe we have a chance to have a fighting chance.
Maya Espinoza started college when she was 17, a single mom while in college, finished her bachelor's degree from PLU, Pacific Lutheran University, at age 20. So congratulations for what you have already done and already accomplished. I love the fact that you are calling on this official to relinquish their duties at DSHS. I think this issue should be front and center in the governor's race. I think it should be front and center in every legislative race, particularly yours. You said something very interesting. You said that your opponent cast a vote. Tell us about that bill.
Yeah, this bill was exactly the thing that I was referencing, where they, as an excuse to save money, decided to make it easier to release these criminals into our communities by relinquishing that oversight. So if there's no oversight, there's no accountability. And all of the, you know, needless to say, all of the sponsors of the bill were Democrats. There were few. And it was a party line vote.
Okay.
And what's very scary is when we go into what could be a Democratic supermajority, as you mentioned, when that margin becomes wider, it makes it so much easier for, you know, the people that want to be perceived as moderates to take an easy vote. But lucky for me, my opponent's not interested in appearing moderate at all.
Well, here's the part I think that people are genuinely, reasonably confused about, Maya, and that is, it's one thing to say these people, the worst of the worst sex offenders who are deemed such a threat that after their sentence they were sent to the special commitment center, we're going to go ahead and release them, but we have airtight oversight. But instead, from what I've gathered from reading the Times story, which, by the way, was a really good piece of journalism by the Seattle Times. I got to give them credit on that. There is no oversight.
No.
And that's why there have, when people suddenly find out that there's going to be a home with four of these sex offenders, as there was going to be in a home in Tenino. I don't know if Tenino is still in your district or not.
Nearby, yep.
People said there was an uproar, and people said, no, absolutely not.
Yeah, absolutely. And in my district, we have a high number of these adult family homes and these sort of halfway houses that house people like this. But the problem here is that oversight has gone away. We've made it easier for them to go into these halfway houses. We've said it's okay not to notify people. And it's pretty simple. You can notify the police. You can have a tracker. We can monitor these halfway houses. But instead, we've said that this is perfectly fine to just release them back into the neighborhoods. And as this Times report found, they are reoffending at alarming rates. And it really should be no surprise here. The Department of Corrections doesn't think that this would be, you know, a shock. It's just an amazing leap that we've taken from this special commitment center to now say, okay, I'm sure everything will be fine, and release them back into the neighborhoods and just see what happens, a wait-and-see method.
Maya Espinoza is running for the Washington State Senate in the district where these sex offenders are being released from, McNeil Island. Also happens to be where Western State Hospital is located, but also happens to be where, you know, Fort Lewis and the great little town of DuPont, Lakewood, all of Lakewood or part of Lakewood?
We have most of Lakewood now, yep.
Okay. I'll tell you something. I have such belief in your candidacy. I want to announce a campaign donation, $200 to your campaign. And I want you to tell our listeners how they can get involved in your race, how they can donate or volunteer as well, Maya.
Thank you so much for taking leadership on that, John. It means a lot. And as you can imagine, our campaigns are funded by individual donors exactly like you. So anyone listening, you really can help move the ball forward in this race in Pierce County, in Washington today. My website's pretty simple, mayaforus.com, M-A-I-A. You just got to get that part right. Number four. us.com. Please join, sign up to volunteer, you know, subscribe to the newsletter, but every single donation does help us. And in this very competitive district, we can win this with everyone's help.
This is, again, Maya, M-A-I-A, Maya, the number four, mayaforus.com. That's mayaforus.com. Join this campaign. Help make it happen. This would be it wouldn't just flip the district. You would have someone who clearly is a bright, shining conservative star, rising star, replacing a Seattle-style progressive leftist. And that for a town, you know, like DuPont, part of Lakewood, Fort Lewis, for crying out loud, that district deserves a better representative who reflects the district and its priorities. Again, Maya, M-A-I-A, Maya, the number four, mayaforus.com. Maya Espinoza, thanks for joining me on the John Carlson Show this morning.
John, thank you so much for having me and for talking about this important issue and for highlighting these important races in our state.
You
got it. Thank you for doing what you're doing, John.
We'll be doing it till November. Maya Espinoza, running for Washington State Senate in the 28th District, most of Lakewood, DuPont, Fort Lewis area. It is coming up in 19 minutes after 7 o'clock in the morning on the John Carlson Show. There's Philip J. Vandervoort III ready with the next social media sweep. Good morning. Philip J. Vandervoort III, are you connected like a D.C. lobbyist?
That's what our announcer says, right?
I've never quite understood that sounder. I've never quite understood that. Anyway, again, for those of you who were interested in helping Maya Espinoza, again, her campaign is Maya, M-A-I-A, the number 4, us.com. Maya4us.com. I've picked a limited number of races that I'm going to highlight between now and the election. Some of them are statewide races. Some of them are congressional. And some of them are legislative races. And in each one of these cases, they are involving candidates who are both credible, meaning they can hold the job and do good at it, and viable, meaning their campaign can actually win, like Maya Espinoza's, and that involve disproportionate impact. In other words, Maya wants to represent 20th District, but she would have an outsized impact here on Washington State. Same thing with several of the other candidates I'm going to be showcasing. So when I bring you these people, these are people that you're going to want to know a whole lot more about. All right. With that said, Philip J., what's going on in the social media world?
We need to get to some election-related issues for the state of Washington. Let's start off with the recount that will happen tomorrow. The Washington Public Lands Commissioner race, 51-vote margin from second place to third place that involves a Democrat in second place, Dave Upthegroove. Republican in third place, Sue Peterson, 51-vote advantage right now. They're going to do this hand recount. So I take this to mean, John, that the Washington State Republican Party, the Republican Party chair, Jim Walsh, going to be very busy starting Saturday and on through this process. How long do you anticipate this takes? 3-4 days to maybe longer? What's the anticipation sort out this race?
Both parties are covering this one like a blanket. There were nearly 2 million votes cast.
In the
nearly
primary.
2 million votes cast in this race. And in about a 41% primary turnout, which is going to be about half of the general election. But 2 million votes, hand counted, that's a lot of votes. Mm-hmm. That's going to take a while.
So we'll wait and see what happens with that, but that process begins tomorrow. That's why I wanted to bring it up here in the social media sweep sponsored by Muckleshoot Casino Resort.
But, Phil, if I'm not mistaken, I believe the law allows the loser of this recount, and again, right now there's just a 50-vote difference, 2 million votes cast.
51 votes, yeah.
51 votes, 2 million. Yeah. The loser will be permitted to, at their own cost...
Good reminder.
Have yet another recount of the ballots. I believe that's what state law allows.
I feel like that's come up that way in the past. It's
well, that's how Gregoire won governor.
The candidate has to pay for it.
Yeah. Dino Rossi won the first count. He won the second count, and the third count went Gregoire's way, and so she took the office.
Mm-hmm. Now, you and I have been talking about this off the air. There's more confusion about this. I checked with our news desk staff at our sister station, KNWN, Northwest News Radio. And there seems to be some confusion about, are we going to have a debate between the candidates for governor in the state of Washington or not? As of an hour ago, it's 2 hours old now. Fox 13 in Seattle posted on social media the 2024 Washington gubernatorial debate between Bob Ferguson and Dave Reichert has been canceled after Ferguson withdrew from the event. So, as of last night, Como News, as an example, was reporting that this debate was going to be on. It was going to happen on September 10th. It was going to happen immediately following the Trump-Kamala Harris debate. And now, according to Fox 13 in Seattle, this is not going to happen. So, we'll have to try and check.
What was his reason?
That I'm not completely clear on. I do have this statement from Dave Reichert, although this was posted last night around 8 o'clock. Reichert posted, "I'm committed to this debate, and I'm disappointed for the voters of Washington that Bob Ferguson is refusing to debate our very different visions for our state. I urge him to change course and join me on stage." And now this one's pointing out October 11th. Mm-hmm. But last night, Como News was talking about something on September 10th. So we'll have to continue to see if we can get hard, firm answers, but it would appear at this point. And Ari Hoffman had posted something about this debate being off last night. And I like I said, I thought it was on when I saw what Ari had posted. And I thought maybe I just saw something that Ari had posted too soon and then news changed. But Ari kind of pointed out something significant about Bob Ferguson. Here's Bob Ferguson trying to change the tune of everything that he's done as attorney general, but now saying he'll do stuff differently if he's elected governor, and he does not want to take the opportunity to debate Dave Reichert.
Right.
Scratch your head on that one.
Bottom line on this is I think that Ferguson is, you know, Ferguson is notorious for hiding from media that he thinks will ask him tough questions.
Yeah, he's not really in a hurry to do those types of interviews, is he?
Hasn't come on the show in over 6 years.
Yeah.
And again, we're polite, but we're also very pointed and very specific. He's a coward. You know, he's afraid of dealing with tough questions. And it's hard to respect someone like that. There's plenty of liberals. You know, Pramila Jayapal has come on. Adam Smith comes on several times.
Yeah, especially when Ferguson's trying to change his tune about what he's done for his entire time as attorney general.
So, you know, unless you've got stuff to hide, you don't duck like this. And that's what Ferguson is doing right now, it sounds like.
We'll try and get some hard, fast answers here.
We've got Steve Moore. By the way, we're happy to host both Reichert and Bob Ferguson on the John Carlson Show, separately or together. It is coming up on 7:30. Steve Moore, frequent guest on Fox News, our chief economist on the John Carlson Show, joins me un momento. 25 minutes to 8 o'clock in the morning, 7:35 on the radio program of record, the John Carlson Show, Talk Radio 570 KVI. Man, there's all sorts of reasons I'm glad that we have Steve Moore, frequent Fox News guest, author of the great and it seems timeless book, GovZilla. That's G-O-V-Zilla, as in Godzilla, GovZilla, about the increasing growth of the Leviathan state. It just keeps getting validated and vindicated by what goes on around us in Washington, D.C. And, of course, most esteemed as chief economist of the John Carlson Show. Good morning, Steve.
Good morning, John. Boy, how much time have we got? We've got a lot of stuff to discuss this morning. It's been just a blizzard of economic information. I guess we should probably start with this jaw-dropping Kamala Harris tax plan that was just released late yesterday afternoon. Kamala didn't talk a lot about it in her speech. Gee, I wonder why. But this would be, you know, this is not a fire drill. This is the real thing. I mean, this would be a $5 trillion 10-year tax increase, the biggest tax increase in the history of the world. It is an assault on American businesses, small businesses, or corporations. It's something, it's like a gift to the Chinese and the Japanese and the Mexicans who are trying to steal our jobs and steal our factories and businesses. I've never seen anything like it. It has a double of the capital gains tax, which means businesses won't get investment to start up new startup companies. It has the first ever tax on unrealized capital gains. And by the way, I'm calling that, John, it's a federal property tax. That's what this is. You know, if you own property and it appreciates in value, they're going to tax it. Do you think I could call that a property tax?
Well, yes, and it's also, as far as I know, unprecedented. We're dealing right now not with property, but with your own money. And they're saying if you—
That is your property, John. That's my point. I mean, you're exactly right. But it would tax you on your stock. Stock, that's your property. It would tax you on your home. It would tax you on a ranch, a farm, any anything that you own if it appreciates in value. And here's the thing. I want to make sure people understand how sinister this is. Let's say you own a farm, okay? And, you know, you've got a lot of rural farms in outside the Seattle area. Mm-hmm. And let's say, you bought it for, say, $250,000 25 years ago, and now let's say it's worth maybe $5 million because the land is appreciated in value. You'd have to pay a 20% tax to Uncle Sam next year for almost $1 million. Now, where's the farmer going to get the $1 million, John?
Yeah, because, again, this is important. This isn't a tax when you sell that farm. It's just a tax on the increase in value that's on paper.
Paper. It's paper. And how's that? What's the government going to do? Have assessors come and by the way, do you think that those could give you your money back if the business or the property falls in value?
Now this, of course not. No, you're not going to get a tax cut.
Yeah, it's heads I win, tails you lose.
So we have.
I shouldn't be laughing. I mean, this is serious stuff. I mean, folks. I mean, I don't care if you like Donald Trump, hate him, and the speech last night was just isn't Donald Trump a terrible guy? And look, everybody has their own opinion about it. I'm just telling you that if Kamala Harris were elected and she put this into place, it would destroy our free market capitalist system.
Yeah, well, the other thing is that what did in Jimmy Carter in his lone term of office, people forget, what did in Jimmy Carter was no one was investing. The capital gains tax was so high that no one was investing, and that's why I think it was a congressman named Bill William Steiger out of Wisconsin.
Yes, a Democrat.
I think it was a Republican, but there are a lot of Democrats were on the bill, and the bottom line on the tax is they said, look, we can't grow as an economy if people don't invest in new businesses, in expanding businesses. That's how the capitalist system works, and the cap gains tax was too high. Now the Democrats want to not just inch it up, they want to raise it dramatically,
double it. Yeah, double it. It's 24% today. It almost doubles to 43% under their plan. What you're talking about is so right, John, but this goes in one ear and out the other of a liberal progressive Democrat because they don't know anything about business. In fact, they hate business. This is the most anti-business ticket in the it's a screed against people who, how dare you build a business and employ people and make a profit? I mean, I think they think profit is a dirty word. And I would make the case to you, John, on your show as your chief economist, that profit is what makes the world go round. Profit is the greatest invention ever because it what stimulates people to start a business and to get rich. And, that's called the American dream the last time I checked. And they act as if it's like, oh, my God, John Carlson, you started a business. Look at that. You're a millionaire now.
Oh, no.
Take your money away from him.
Yeah. Hey, you started a business. Oh, no. It made a profit. It doesn't.
Without profits.
It doesn't quite resonate, does it?
If I sound a little angry, I am. I mean, I can't believe we have a major presidential candidate. We have two major parties, and one of the candidates is talking about destroying our businesses. Here's the other thing.
Something you should keep in mind, something important you should keep in mind, and you probably already know this, between the existing vice president, Kamala Harris, her running mate, who would be Vice President Tim Walz, and the current president of the United States, Joe Biden, none of them has spent a day in the private sector.
That's amazing. That's amazing.
Their entire lives are all government. Well, with the exception of between her freshman and sophomore year in college, Kamala Harris worked at a McDonald's.
So she did have a private sector.
That's it. Her life, her career after getting out of school.
They have 3 months of business.
After getting out of school, her life has been government. Tim Walz, government. Joe Biden, politics and government.
Yes. And that's why they don't understand, how a business works. I mean, can you imagine asking one of those three to start a business? They wouldn't even
know what to do.
Sharpen a pencil. And so this is I just want to make sure your listeners understand that this is a very, very dangerous idea. I was starting to say, John, that my son started a business, a technology business.
Good.
He's raised maybe $4 or $5 million of capital. These are people who put their money at risk. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as you know, 2 out of 3 small businesses fail. So you're putting your money at risk. Most people who invest in a small business lose their money, and you're hoping, you know, that this might be that next Google, or it might be a company that catches on. So it's at risk capital. You put your money up. And if you now what Kamala Harris is saying, by the way, if the business succeeds, we're going to tax you multiple times. And out of the dollar gain that you make, you're going to keep about 25 cents and we're going to get 75 cents. Now, who's going to invest under those circumstances?
Right. Well, and there's another tax, and that is she wants to raise the corporate income tax.
Yes.
That Trump brought down so that it would be commensurate with the corporate income tax rates in other countries, because we were losing businesses to other countries, lower tax burden.
Very good, John. I mean, you must have read our book, Trumponomics, because that's exactly the point. And, you know, when I helped Trump put that plan together. And
yes.
that was the gemstone of our tax policy. We're looking at it like, wait a minute. Here's U.S. way up here with our rating of 40%, and the rest of the world's down below 20%. And, you know, sorry, that doesn't work. It's like, you know, as Trump once said, you know, when I showed him these charts, he said, Steve, that's like putting a tariff on our own goods and services.
Good for him.
What kind of country would do that?
Real quickly, because I want to get this in, and I know you've got a really busy morning here, Steve Moore. And we always appreciate.
Yeah, Kamala is keeping me very busy, John.
Going out of your way to join us here in Seattle on the John Carlson Show every Friday. It was just announced earlier this morning by Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell that the time has come to cut interest rates.
Yes. So I think this is bad timing. I think to do this 2 months before an election smacks to me, and I know people have different opinions on this, but to me that smacks of election interference. I mean, 2 months before an election, who do you think that Jerome Powell wants to be the next president? Mm-hmm. And, you know, look, they keep saying how they that we can't be political. We're the Fed, you know, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
Okay, if you're not going to be political, why would you do something like that?
They waited until now, and they announced it the day after the Democratic convention finished business.
I mean, I'm sorry. I think this idea that the Fed is politically independent, it should be politically independent, right, but it is not. And I think Jerome Powell here has shown his true colors.
Let me give an example.
Why can't they wait until December? Is there some reason they can't wait?
Yeah. Let me give an example of the Fed operating as it should. Back when Jimmy Carter was president, inflation out of control, he was told you need to get an inflation fighter, someone with an impeccable reputation in the highest echelons of the economy. So he picks Paul Volcker to be the Fed chairman. His term came up. I think they have, 6 or 7 year terms? His term.
I think four.
Are you just four? Okay. Well, his term came up when Reagan was president.
Reagan reappointed him.
And Reagan reappointed Paul Volcker.
Even though he's raising rates. This is a good point, John, you're making. Paul Volcker and Reagan were the heroes who conquered the inflation of the 1970s. And, you know, we went from when Reagan came in and then Volcker, you know, to control the Fed, we took inflation down from 11% to 4%. And we didn't have high inflation in the 1970s because of greedy businesses and price gouging. It's because we were spending and borrowing too much money. That's the thing that infuriates me. You know, I didn't hear one sentence in her speech last night. Now, I didn't listen to the whole thing. I listened to the first half, and then I got bored with it. But I didn't hear her talk about anything but raising taxes, not a single spending cut, not one dime.
Yeah. No, you're right. I'm trying to think in my head, is there any spending cut at all? No, nothing, nothing.
Nothing.
Just a laundry list.
More spending. New government programs.
But again, the corporate income tax rate would go up
to 28.
From 21 to 28.
We'll have the highest business tax rate. We'll have, I think, in the world, but don't quote me on that. There might be one or two countries that have higher than that.
So we're going right back to where we were before the tax plan, the tax cut and reform plan of President Trump unleashed the fastest, boldest economic growth in, well, at least since the heyday of the Reagan era, and maybe before then. And again, they're going right back to the old playbook that didn't work. So
John, I got to tell you quick, I'm going to let you in on a quick secret in our last 60 seconds here.
Yep.
New book coming out in 4 weeks called The Trump Economic Miracle by Stephen Moore and Arthur Laffer. And we address all of these issues side by side. This is what Trump did. This is what Biden Harris did on the economy. Americans, you choose. But have your eyes wide open. Know what happened under Trump. Know what happened under Biden and Kamala Harris. If you want 4 more years of this, folks, you should vote for Kamala Harris.
Beautiful. Excellent. We're looking forward to that, Steve Moore. I think maybe you should swing by Seattle if you do a book tour.
We will.
Very good. Thanks a lot. Have a great weekend, Steve Moore. Our chief economist, you see him all the time on Fox News. He's taken a special interest in Talk Radio 570 KVI. We appreciate that. It is 11 minutes to 8 o'clock. John Carlson Show, Talk Radio 570 KVI. Kamala Harris had some interesting things to say about the Middle East. You'll be hearing what they are. They're very revealing. Very revealing. And especially when you juxtapose what she says about the Middle East with what she said about Ukraine and how resolute she was that we're standing by Ukraine. And then in the Middle East, it's, well, Israel has a right to defend itself and we support that, but this war's got to stop. It's just kind of a different view. Anyway, let's finish this hour local here. 4 juveniles arrested in Kent after a police chase involving a stolen car. This ended in Kent, where they had that huge, massive fire earlier this morning. I thought it was in South Seattle. I was driving across Lake Washington Bridge, and you could see it. It was an inferno. You could see the flames. And I, again, thought it was in South Seattle. It was clear off in Kent. And I'm glad they have that fire under control. Anyway, here are, again, 4 juveniles. What do you want to bet? It wasn't their first run-in with the law in a stolen car.
3 teenagers from Seattle were arrested after a police chase in a stolen car that ended in Kent. Kent police say around 4:15 in the afternoon on Tuesday, officers tracked the stolen vehicle near Central Avenue North and South 228th Street. This is where the police chase started. Then shortly after, officers were able to do a pit maneuver and pin the stolen car in place with the police cruiser. The teens inside the stolen car, they tried to then run away. A canine officer quickly caught up with the driver, a 16-year-old boy. 2 other passengers, a 15-year-old girl and a 13-year-old, were found hiding nearby and arrested. The driver was arrested for possession of a stolen vehicle, eluding and obstruction of public officers.
The only good news, by the way, I stand corrected. I thought it was 4. It was 3 juveniles. The only good news about this is that police would not have been allowed a year ago to chase this stolen car with 3 juveniles inside. Now they are, and that is a very, very good thing. Thank you, Brian Haywood. That initiative is now law. Please have that freedom.
Yeah, it's all about keeping an additive positude. Positude additive.
Something like that. It is Friday. Friday on the John Carlson Show, Talk Radio 570 KVI, radio program of record. Thank you for joining us. Doesn't seem like a nice August morning. A little blustery out there. But hope you're going to have a wonderful weekend ahead. The Democratic Convention is over. We're going to get to it in just a second. Before we do, I want to start local because the local story of the week is that horrifying carjacking and killing of an 80-year-old woman, Ruth Dalton. by an 8-time felon who has an earlier conviction for killing someone with a car. That is what Jamaad Haynes now stands accused of doing to Ruth Dalton, violently carjacking her and then, according to a witness, deliberately backing over her as she lay in the street. He then, with her dog in the back of the car, drives to a parking lot at Beacon Hill and, according to witnesses, stabs her dog to death and throws it in a trash can. He apparently had never met this woman before. But, hey, he wanted her car. This guy has been in and out of prison and mental institutions for most of his adult life. Here is what Como 4 has discovered about Jamaad Haynes' prior arrests, including his time at Western State Hospital.
Police call the suspect a tremendous danger to the public. They also say that he resisted officers when he was taken into custody and then didn't make any statements to investigators. I've been digging into his criminal history. In that, I found concerns from a psychologist who said that the suspect was a high risk for committing future crimes. Jamaad Haynes is accused of the shocking murder of 80-year-old Ruth Dalton. Police say it was a random carjacking where Haynes is accused of running Ruth over, then stabbing her dog Prince to death. Now we're learning about his criminal history, which started 3 decades ago. In the 90s, Haynes was convicted of multiple crimes, including vehicular homicide. He served less than 2 years in prison, but was back in custody not long after. In 99, he was convicted of robbery, and in 2003, assault. We learned that assault was on a prison officer here at the Monroe Correctional Facility. He allegedly stabbed the guard with a 12-inch shank. That case prompted a judge to send Haynes to the Western State Hospital for mental health treatment.
Someone want to explain to me why someone this volatile and someone this violent was out of prison in the first place? So he was sent to Western State after stabbing a corrections officer at Monroe. All right, what happened then?
There, a psychologist's report noted that Haynes had signs of psychosis and paranoia and, quote, if he discontinues his medication, which he says he will most likely decompensate in a rather short period of time. The report went on to say Haynes is, quote, high risk for committing future criminal acts jeopardizing public safety. Haynes was sent back to prison where he stayed until 2017. He was released, complied with the terms of his supervision until that expired in 2018. Court records show Haynes hasn't had any new criminal cases in Seattle until he was arrested for Ruth Dalton's murder this week. The case has rightly outraged many in the city and has become a flashpoint in the region's fight to control crime, with both candidates for Washington governor weighing in on X. Dave Reichert saying, quote, years of unchecked lawlessness and tying the hands of our officers has gotten us to this point. And Bob Ferguson, who is currently the attorney general, thanking Seattle police and saying the person responsible needs to be prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law.
I'd like to know why he was out. Again, we're talking about an 8-time felon who stabbed, who had already killed someone with a car, who then stabbed a corrections officer at Monroe and was sent to Western State, and they sent him back to Monroe and let him go. They sent him back to prison and let him go. This is, again, just an example of everything that is wrong with Washington State's approach to criminal justice. And this should be seen as the case that changed all that. I have a feeling it won't. You know, you have a, 8-month pregnant Korean businesswoman who's shot and killed on 4th Avenue, downtown Seattle, as she's in the turn lane waiting to drive to her restaurant that she and her husband, who was in the car with her, who was wounded, run together or used to run together. That didn't wake the community up. Again, random, savage, vicious act of violence. And nothing's going to get done until we change the people who are there. Nothing's going to get done. Seattle has started, but they need to pick up the pace. They need to pick up the pace. All right, you got 10 minutes after 8. Let us go to Kamala Harris last night. I watched her speech in full. It was, to her credit, not as long as Joe Biden's. It was came in at about 36 minutes. Little light on details. Steve Moore just gave you some of the details that were certainly missing from last night's speech. Much of it was also biographical, like when she described her work as a prosecutor.
I fought against the cartels who traffic in guns and drugs and human beings, who threaten the security of our border and the safety of our communities.
If they threaten our border so much, then why have you followed a policy that has made cartels so much stronger? I mean, talk about no sense of self-awareness, no sense of irony here. You have all but opened the border, and you just here in your speech are talking about how cartels are exploiting our border to traffic in drugs, people, and other assorted contraband.
And I will tell you, these fights were not easy. And
they're not easy. They're not happening is the problem.
Neither were the elections that put me in those offices. We were underestimated at practically every turn. But we never gave up, because the future is always worth fighting for.
Okay. It's a good applause line, but may I just remind everybody, Kamala Harris is a San Francisco liberal running in a one-party city for DA, and then running in a one-party state. All the major offices, all the statewide offices are held by Democrats. In a one-party state for attorney general. A race she very nearly lost, by the way. She just barely won it by half a percentage, one half of a percentage point. So even when she's running in a heavily Democrat-dominated state, she barely wins office. And then she wins election to the Senate because they have a top two system. They're running against another Democrat. So that's the context that needs to be taken into account here. Oh, and where is she on the border?
After decades in law enforcement, I know the importance of safety and security, especially at our border. Last year, Joe and I brought together Democrats and conservative Republicans to write the strongest border bill in decades. The Border Patrol endorsed it. But Donald Trump believes a border deal would hurt his campaign. So he ordered his allies in Congress to kill the deal. Refuse to play politics with our security. And here is my pledge to you. As president, I will bring back the bipartisan border security bill that he killed, and I will sign it into law.
Okay. Shall we talk for just a moment about what that bill does? It establishes a tolerance policy on illegal immigration, a daily tolerance policy. As long as it stays below 2,000 people a day illegally crossing the border, as long as it stays below 2,000, it's all right. But when it gets above, I think it's 2,500, then they're going to start increasing enforcement at the border. It's a freaking tolerance policy on illegal, on slow motion illegal immigration. Can't believe that any Republican in his right mind was negotiating for this. But again, this is what sometimes happens. You got to keep your eye on Republicans when they go back to Washington, D.C. Sometimes strange things happen. And Donald Trump did exactly the right thing. So anyway, just thought you should have the context behind that. All right, now let's go from the border, which remains chaotically defended in the United States. And by the way, credit Donald Trump for being at the border. Not only that, a dangerous spot on the border. He had to move at one point. Kamala Harris only made one border appearance as border czar. And yes, she was the border czar. And that was to a very safe indoor area. She never had so much as a conversation, the border czar, never had so much as a conversation with the head of the Border Patrol. And she's going to be the person to get our border controlled? I don't think so. This is all going to be coming out here. Here is Kamala Harris talking about Ukraine and then pivoting to the Middle East. Notice how differently she speaks about our commitment to Ukraine versus Israel. Have a listen.
As president, I will stand strong with Ukraine and our NATO allies.
Okay, good, strong. Good, strong, forthright defense. No qualifiers here. Just, I will stand strong with Ukraine and our NATO allies. That's impressive. All right.
With respect to the war in Gaza,
yeah.
President Biden and I are working around the clock because now is the time to get a hostage deal and a ceasefire deal done.
Oh. Why aren't we hearing? Now, she's going to say, oh, and I do believe Israel has the right to defend itself. Where is we stand strong with Israel's right to defend itself and to eradicate Hamas? No, doesn't quite get to that level.
Let me be clear. I will always stand up for Israel's right to defend itself. To defend itself, because the people of Israel must never again face the horror that a terrorist organization called Hamas caused on October 7.
Okay, so why not simply say, in Israel's war against a terrorist organization, Hamas, we stand strong with Israel? Why is that so hard? Why is that so difficult? She could say that, but no, she says, no, we need a ceasefire.
Unspeakable sexual violence and the massacre of young people at a music festival. At the same time, what has happened in Gaza over the past 10 months is devastating. So many.
And Hamas is committing a war crime by putting civilians in front of their fighters. Is she going to say that?
Innocent lives lost. Desperate, hungry. hungry people fleeing for safety over and over again. The scale of suffering is heartbreaking.
Still no blame of Hamas.
President Biden and I are working to end this war such that Israel is secure, the hostages are released, the suffering in Gaza ends, and the Palestinian people can realize their right to dignity, security, freedom, and self-determination.
Oh, everybody's a winner. Everybody comes out ahead. Here is what moral clarity would have been here, okay? Moral clarity would have been, and the Palestinian people can move forward knowing that the obstacle to peace between Israel and the Palestinian people, namely the terror group Hamas, is no more. That's what she should have said. She should have clarified that Palestinians won't have autonomy, that Palestinians won't have any shot at freedom or a homeland as long as groups like Hamas, terrorists like Hamas, that don't want Israel to be safe, that don't want Jews in Israel at all, are not in the picture. She couldn't quite get to that, could she? It's coming up here on 821. You know what that means? Philip J. Vandenberg III right around the corner, not just with the social media sweep, but his favorite segment of the day, the last one of the week. Social media from socialists on the John Carlson Show. Okay, so this is going to blow your mind, Philip J. Vandenberg III. Do you realize more time has passed since this movie about Buddy Holly, the death of Buddy Holly, Richie Valens.
Yeah, Valens.
And Buddy Holly.
It's been a while since I've seen the movie. I wasn't sure if they included all of that with the Richie Valens story, but it did focus on Richie Valens.
Yeah, at the end, that's what it all gets down to is his early demise and Buddy Holly and the Big Boppers as well. But more time has passed since that movie.
Wow, yeah.
About Richie Valens, then passed from the time of his death to the movie itself.
The movie, yeah.
So, yikes.
But that song, in 1987, that Los movie Lobos. Came out. Lou Diamond Phillips exactly played Richie Valens, Los Lobos, do the excellent version of La Bamba, and that song was everywhere the summer of 1987.
Yep.
Could not have been avoided because it was great resurgence and all there as part of the movie.
Yes. I should say more time. As much time has passed since that movie as passed since the death of Buddy Holly when the movie came out. Okay. Mm-hmm. Or Richie Valens
Mileposts,
when the movie came out.
Right.
So what is happening?
This one's good.
All right. Social media from socialists.
This one's pretty delicious.
Good.
It all revolves around the DNC convention in Chicago.
Yeah.
I don't know that this happened before Kamala Harris's speech last night, but this was posted yesterday afternoon. So this may have been related to Wednesday afternoon's proceedings and then the daytime coverage yesterday from CNN. But basically, I'm going to play you about a minute in change of CNN, and they're talking with the congressional reporter Manu Raju, who on the floor at the convention interviewed a variety of different congressional Democrats there in attendance at the convention in Chicago yesterday. And they do a brilliant job of moving the goalposts on what a presidential election should all be about.
Okay, and again, this is the CNN political correspondent.
Yeah, social media sweep sponsored by Muckleshoot Casino Resort. So it's going to start off with one of the CNN hosts, then it's going to shift over to Manu Raju, who's going to kind of introduce the comments that he had previously edited down from the congressional Democrats he spoke to.
Okay. Then you hear the criticism, she has to do more interviews, she has to talk about policy. Interesting from insiders you're speaking to, they're sort of like, no, absolutely not. Haven't needed to do it so far. Yeah. Why start now?
And that's exactly it. They're concerned about her doing that could potentially trip her up and give Trump some ammunition. In fact, a lot of those Democrats I spoke to today said avoid those policy prescriptions.
Wow.
So here come the congressional Democrats.
I haven't heard from many voters looking for white papers and policy papers. What they want to hear is what her vision is for this country.
So that's a congressional member from Georgia.
In other words, I think there's a little bit of a difference between a white paper, which is heavily detailed.
It gets into detail.
And simply taking a clear position on an issue.
Good distinction there.
Rather than my vision for the future.
Okay, here's a few more congressional Democrats.
This is rich.
The American people don't vote on policy prescriptions.
I actually think the way the American people think about this choice is less about the minutia of policy and more about the direction of the country, number one. And secondly, about the personal character.
Who's this?
It does matter.
I'd have to look up who that specific one was.
Jerry Connolly, the congressman from Virginia there, I asked him more about this. He said, remember what Elizabeth Warren did when she ran back in 2020? She had a white paper for every policy position under the sun. And what happened? She collapsed in the primary. So there's a belief that perhaps you put more ideas on paper, that's a bad idea. But the question is, voters want to see some of those ideas.
Right. Maybe, but we'll if you go with the vibes, it's a vibes election.
Right, that's right.
There it is. It's a vibes election. You don't have to have substance. You just have to have flash.
A content-free election.
Yeah,
how about
basically.
That?
If you go with the vibes, it's a vibes election.
Right.
So that's
right.
CNN host Cassie Hunt there at the end going, it's a vibes election. We're just voting on vibes. We're not voting on who could get anything done, who might make anything better, who might improve things. We're just voting on vibes.
Again, well, but by the way, also very revealing because it shows you that the Democrats themselves know that as soon as they take clear positions on issues, they start to lose. As soon as they're specific about what they want to do, they start to lose. This tells you everything. That was a very revealing little sketch there. That was wonderful. All right, it's coming up on 8:35. Mariners lost a manager yesterday. We'll talk a little bit about that coming up on The Commute with Carlson. All right, we are back. We don't know if Donald Trump or if Kamala Harris is going to be a loser in November. I think I know, but I don't want to tip my hand just yet. However, Scott Servais, who has helmed the Seattle Mariners. He's been the manager of the Seattle Mariners Baseball Club for over 9 years. Do you know it's been that long, Philip J.? Over 9 years, Scott Servais has been manager. And it just wasn't working. It just wasn't working. He was back in Seattle yesterday morning preparing for a meeting at noon with team president Jerry DePoto. Both Scott Servais and Jerry DePoto, by the way, were Major League Baseball players at one point, even competed against each other. When he saw a breaking news alert on TV notifying him and everybody else watching TV that he'd been fired after 9 years with the Mariners. Hand-picked by Jerry DePoto as manager back in October of 2015. Well, if we want to get an insight into what this means, ladies and gentlemen, you know what we do. Go to our senior sports correspondent, Matthew Carlson. Right. 24 minutes to 9 o'clock, and sports correspondent Matthew Carlson with us this morning. Hello, Matthew.
Good morning, Dad. Thanks for letting me close out the show. Hopefully it'll be a cleaner close than some of these recent baseball games.
By the way, you've got a fan out there in KVI land, came up to me yesterday. I was at a an event for a good friend, Rick Cook, who just celebrated a birthday. And Jim Zorn, Seahawks quarterback, came in and talked about how impressed he was with your sports reports.
Oh, that's high praise from a great man. So that if Jim's listening, thank you so much, Jim. I appreciate that.
Isn't that something? All right.
Yeah, so awesome. Seahawks season right around the corner, too, but Right now, it's the Mariners. Oh, boy. What a story.
Well, do tell. Were you surprised?
With 34 games left in the season, a little bit. Clearly, after that absolutely abysmal 1-8 road trip, getting swept in Detroit, only taking one from Pittsburgh, and then getting obliterated by the Dodgers in Los Angeles, a change needed to be made. This is a Mariners team, as we talked about earlier this season, that had a 10-game division lead on June 18th.
Yeah.
And promptly withered away and blew that lead, you know, in 24 games. All it took was 24 games to blow that 10-game division lead. They now find themselves 5 games back and a, frankly, a mediocre baseball team. They're 500 right now, 64-64. So in order to win the division, they need to make up 5 games on the Houston Astros in the next 34. And in order to get a wild card spot, they need to make up even more ground than that. So things are looking pretty bleak for the.
Okay, we lost your signal there briefly. Okay.
Pardon me. Things are looking pretty bleak right now, and it just wasn't working under current management.
All right. Now, Dan Wilson, former Mariners catcher, is going to succeed Scott Servais as the full-time manager. He won't be an interim. He's got the full-time job. Why did this happen? I mean, what went wrong? Again, we were 10 games up. People were thinking, could we possibly win 95 wins, maybe even 100? And then, as you pointed out, in 24 games, everything just collapsed. There was no particular injury or no particular clubhouse scandal or tension, you know, that melted down the clubhouse that I'm aware of. What happened in 24 games?
In 24 games, the Mariners continue.
Oh, Matt, we're having trouble with your signal again. I don't know where you're talking to me from, but we just missed the last 15 seconds of what you said.
Oh, here. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay. Copy that. I apologize. The Mariners have the best pitching rotation in the American League.
Right.
They have, without a doubt, the worst offense in the American League. They're last or bottom five in every offensive category, last in batting average. The team is hitting .216, and they lead the league with a 28% strikeout percentage. Offensively, whatever type of magic potion, whatever type of lineup alignment, it just wasn't getting done. And the Mariners were losing heartbreaking loss after heartbreaking loss after quality start after quality start.
Well, I remember when we were riding high, and this might be all the way back in 2001, the slogan for the Mariners that year was, two outs, so what? Because of our penchant for coming through in the clutch. Boy, now it looks like that in reverse.
Yeah. No, and hiring Dan Wilson, Dan the man, Dan's never managed at any level of baseball, ever. That I know of, or that's been reported, minor leagues or even high school, college. But he definitely knows what it's like to be on a winning baseball team, and he was part of those magical runs from the mid to late 90s into the early 2000s. But essentially, this team just lost its mojo. We talked about Soto mojo, you know, back when I was a kid,
and this
team just offensively was just soulless, unfortunately. Julio Rodriguez, a down year, injuries, certain offensive acquisitions just not coming to fruition. And unfortunately, you know, the buck stops here with the manager, as President Truman would say. And he was the fall guy in this situation.
Again, what is mystifying about this is usually you see something like this happen when a key player, marquee player, suffers an injury and is, you know, off, or you know, one of your star pitchers is hurt and you know, has bone spurs, you know, and can't pitch. But again, this just looks like a meltdown for no reason that I can really put my finger on. Does anything
With the exception of Victor Robles, who was acquired from the Nationals, who just earned himself a two-year extension, it comes down to almost every single offensive acquisition of the last couple seasons. And people have, you know, some people blame payroll, you know, not being willing to pay people. Some people blame the ballpark, you know, and its dimensions and the climate around it.
We won 116 ball games in that ballpark in 2001.
Yeah. It just, almost every single offensive acquisition of the last half decade plus just has not come to fruition for the Mariners. In terms of free agency, I should say. A lot of great, you know, Cal Raleigh developed, Julio Rodriguez developed. Yeah. But, you know, and then players like Ty France is the perfect example. He was wallowing around, you know, 200, 210s. He gets picked up by Cincinnati, immediately starts hitting 260. So the Mariners also, along with Scott Service, who, by the way, I think it's worth saying is a very good man, very invested in his community, does a ton of charity work around Seattle.
We were going to have him on the show either yesterday or today. We were going to have Scott Service on the show to talk about one of his charities. He and his wife involved in animal welfare. But, you know, again, it's just so sad, you know, to see it end this way. We did make the playoffs with Scott Service and nearly made the playoffs again the year later. But, man, what are the chances we're going to make the playoffs this year, Matt?
Very low. Mathematically, still a possibility, but I wouldn't. We got to be careful sports betting to begin with, but I wouldn't bet on it. Unfortunately, I'll always be optimistic, but the Mariners got a lot of teams to move past and a lot of ball games they need to win. By the way, Scott Service, pretty well cemented 680 and 642 with the Mariners as the second best manager in Mariners history.
What's his overall record?
680 and 642.
680 and 642.
So 38 games over 500. 38 games over 500.
Who's the best? Lou Piniella?
Oh, it's Sweet Lou. Yeah. Sweet Lou. But again, one other little nugget here. Things happen, but really, really disappointing, as Adam Jude of the Seattle Times said, that he found out about this just like we all did. No one after 9 years of hard work deserves to find out they've lost their job like that. So. Yeah.
It should be very obvious. You can't keep in a secret like that. Usually, I hate to say this, Matt, usually this is the way that someone learns they've lost the job, when management wants to make their departure more humiliating.
Yeah.
I hope that wasn't, and I don't think it was the intent of Mariners management to do that. Again, if you're just joining me, Scott Service, fired yesterday as manager of the Mariners, found out while watching TV.
Yeah.
He had a noon meeting scheduled with a GM and friend who hired him in the first place, Jerry DePoto. And at 10:30, he's watching TV, and the banner comes across, the Chyron comes across. Scott Service to be fired.
Yeah. No, and him and Jerry DePoto, like you said, pretty close friends. Both came over from the Angels when nine years ago when they started this current iteration, this current regime in Seattle. So hopefully we can chalk it up to a massive mistake, and they still keep Scott around and on good terms with the organization. By the way, tidbit as well, other than Scott Service, hitting coach for the Mariners also let go yesterday. And along with Dan Wilson, Edgar Martinez will be joining the staff of the official staff down there in the dugout.
How much do coaches make?
Instructor.
How much do coaches make?
Managers and coaches, it very much depends. I haven't heard any details about Dan Wilson's contract, but it could be into the six figures to seven figures. A really good baseball manager will make seven figures. Nothing like an NFL or college coach, though.
Good point. Good point.
Two different, you do quite comfortably, I'm sure. But
Yeah, and not, so Edgar used to be the hitting coach, and then he left about 6 years ago, right?
That's correct. That's correct. He was hitting coach for a few seasons, left around 2018, but has always been affiliated with the club. I believe he's been a special advisor since.
No, he's...
So interesting. Yeah.
If there's a Mr. Mariner, I know some people say Griffey, some people say Ichiro. My nominee would be Edgar.
Edgar. Alvin Davis still owns the moniker.
Yeah.
Mr. Mariner from back in the day. But well, yeah, Edgar.
For good reason. He was doing well when nobody else was doing well.
he was the one. He was the draw. Yeah. So Mariners have some fun series coming up here. Three against the Giants starting today, the San Francisco Giants at T-Mobile. So hopefully the fans can get down to the stadium, enjoy the last 34 games, and we'll see what happens.
Well, it could still happen. All right. Very good analysis, Matthew Carlson, our senior sports correspondent. Thanks very much for joining me this morning, Matt.
My pleasure, Dad. Seahawks play at 7 on Saturday. Love you.
Love you, too. All right. It is 8:49, 11 minutes to 9 o'clock on a Friday, blustery Friday morning. Best analysis. Best analysis I've heard so far from anybody, media, politics, anywhere, of Kamala Harris's convention speech last night was actually from Donald Trump right after she was done speaking. He spoke by phone with Fox News' Brett Baer and Shannon Bream. Here's what he had to say.
What is your first reaction to it real time tonight?
Well, the biggest reaction is, why didn't she do the things that she's complaining about? All of these things that she talked about, we're going to do this, we're going to do that, we're going to do everything, but she didn't do any of it. She could have done it 3.5 years ago. She could do it tonight by leaving the auditorium and going to Washington, D.C. and closing the border. She doesn't need a bill. I didn't have a bill. I closed the border and created the safest border we've ever had in the history of our country. She could have done all of these things, and she could still do them. She's got 4.5, 5 months left. She can go there right now. She can do all of the things, many of the things that she's talking about and complaining about. It was a lot of complaining. She didn't talk about China. She didn't talk about fracking. She didn't talk about crime. She didn't talk about 70% of our people are living in poverty. She didn't talk about housing, really. The trade deficit, she didn't talk about.
Great point that she's the incumbent. She's not the challenger saying, if you elect me, we're going to do these. She could do it right now. She's part of the Biden-Harris administration. If these are, why didn't she just do these things? That's a wonderful response to the Democrat convention. Okay, we have time to sneak this in, I hope. Yes. Donald Trump, a former spokesman, Steve Cortez, took a young illegal immigrant named Edwin with no ID to the security checkpoint around the perimeter of the convention site in Chicago, saying he's here illegally and he would like to thank the Democrats and he would like to get in and attend the convention.
Hey, Steve Cortez here on the west side of Chicago, Democratic National Convention at United Center. The Democrats, of course, want open borders and want an endless stream of illegal migrants pouring into the United States. This is my new acquaintance, Edwin. Say hello.
My name's Edwin.
Go to Jackson.
Yep.
Wait, you mean he needs credentials and permission to come in?
Yes.
To get past the wall?
Yeah.
So it's like a border wall in a way, huh?
Yeah. You have to have ID.
You can't come in here. You don't have ID. Think about this the next time the Democrats complain about showing ID at the polls, let alone at the border. Hey, have a great weekend, everybody. Let's talk again Monday.